I'm just going to say a couple of words. There's several people here tonight who were not here for any of the other classes, actually. So just for a few minutes, let me just say that I want to reiterate, those of you who were here 2 weeks ago heard this, that Swamiji wrote these lessons a number of years ago, Swami Kriyananda, who passed 2 years ago, and I think it was two years maybe before that, that he wrote Akash. That doesn't feel old enough, but anyway, 2011, that's what I'm... I think it was 2011, but feels like it was longer ago than that. He wrote them when he was in India, and I just say this for a reason. It was a major piece of work for him. I was just wondering if Ramurti and Sita were living in India at the time. Were you two there? No. But he made it very clear that he wanted these teachings to get out this particular class. He took it from a year-long study group that was very esoteric, that was somewhat challenging to study, but the lessons were so deep. And he said, wait a minute, let me redo this in simple form in a six-week class, and I want you to take it out and teach it and teach it and teach it. And really, in India, when we taught it here 2 years ago, I wrote to the people in India. I'm blocking on his name right now. But he and his wife lived here for years, but I can't think of his name. Anyway, I wrote to him and I said, send me everything that Swamiji sent to you, because I knew how important it was. And he was the man who actually took it out and started traveling around India. Not Haridas, no. Dharmaraj. Thank you. I couldn't think of Dharmaraj's name. I've been on vacation for a week. I couldn't think of Dharmaraj. I couldn't think of the city where he lived. I really vacated for a week. But anyway, I'm back. So, they did a huge publicity piece on it. Major road booklets, put it together beautifully, went out to one city after another after another. I'm saying it because we sent the outline to everybody who was here week one. And if you didn't receive the outline, and you raise your hand for just a minute if you didn't and you'd like to, let me see. Does everybody here have it? The outline of this Akash class? Except for Ken. You got it, Krista. Okay. Rose, I'll send it to you too. So Ken and Rose, we can send it. It's deceptively simple. And it just, you know, last week you talked about kindness. Tonight it's about non-attachment. We talked about, in 1 week, he wants you to talk about integrity, humility, and whatever else the third was. Just these little keys. Often he does it A through Z, which tonight is A through Z. And it's just so simple. But when you listen to what the speakers say, you realize what he's done in 6 weeks is covered the essence of what it means or how to live a spiritual life on a spiritual path. I mean, when you think about non-attachment, I don't want to steal anybody's thunder, but you're really talking about moving from ego consciousness to soul consciousness. That's what you're doing. It's absolutely the core of the spiritual path. So I don't want anybody to be deceived by it. Everything we're talking about, he just said, here, let me very simply throw out these points. Then you go home and you chew on them for a while. And you realize they're simple, but they're not always easy to live. The other thing I'd like to say is when you read it, and I just went and glanced through this chapter tonight before we came out here, but throughout the whole Akash series, Swamiji refers to what Master said when he was alive about this horrible disaster that's coming, this catastrophe. Was this talked about last week at all?
No, that's for this week.
Okay. Oh, it is only for this week. Okay. It's a big part of this week?
This is your part this week.
Oh, my part this week.
The part that you talked about, week one.
Oh. I'm a little confused, but is it okay that I talk about this for a moment? I don't really have an assignment tonight. Okay, it's my part. Here's all I want to say, because actually tonight I thought it was just divided with the two of you, but it doesn't matter. What is really important about it is when Swamiji was alive, there was a period in his life where he was talking wherever he went about this horrible event that was going to occur. And as Master said, this is going to make the depression of the 30s look like nothing. People won't just be hungry. It'll be starvation everywhere. Whole countries will disappear. He literally in a church one night said, you have no idea about the horrible, I forget his exact words, cataclysm that's coming. So he was making no bones about it. It turned a lot of people off when Swamiji was walking around from one country, one city to another, talking about it. Literally, I mean, there were a lot of people who just, they left. People actually left the path, some people. Why would such a great teacher be talking about such dark and negative things? And we, many of us, maybe many people in this room, counseled a lot of people about this. They came to us. It was devastating for people. They wanted to come to church and hear how wonderful everything was and how positive and how uplifting and how light. And that was not Swamiji's message for quite a while. What I want to say is I assume Master said it, Swamiji said it. I'm going to assume it's true. It's going to happen. When it's going to happen, who knows? What's going to happen, who knows? They never said anything. But two or three things I want to say about it. What they did say is, in essence, what Sri Yukteswar said, not quite 100 years, 100 years ago, that everything in the future will improve if you are making spiritual effort now. So whatever happens, whenever it's going to happen, none of us know. You know, you watch the news and you watch 23,000 people were just evacuated because of this valley fire. 23,000. Almost 600 people lost their homes. You know, people sitting there saying, I don't need to leave, I don't need to leave. And then you watch their videos as they're holding their phones. Has anybody else seen this? As they're driving through the fire, trying to race to get out of there. Most of them made it, a couple didn't. People whose families were begging them to get out, and they're missing now. But so we don't know. We don't have to wait. That wasn't the cataclysm. But what we do know is that anything can happen at any time, and everything will improve in the future if we are making spiritual effort. And Master said, those of us who are devoting ourselves to this spiritual path, our spiritual path, not even this spiritual path, but making spiritual effort, that we will be helped, that we will not suffer the way other people will suffer. And that to me is so important. I don't know what that means. Does it mean that because I'm more okay about dying or just leaving this body that I won't suffer as I'm in the fire? I don't know. Or does it mean my house will be the house that doesn't burn down when everything else around it did? We just don't know any of it. So there's no point in trying to figure it all out or getting too stuck in the negativity. I feel, why don't we just hear the message, which is dive deep into spiritual teachings. Appreciate what we can in the moment. Grab onto what we can that will help us through every minute of our lives, even from now until then, whenever then is. It could be a whole other life. We might not even get to remember that Master said it, literally. So I really felt for those people who were so, I think, really frightened by it, is what it must have been, just so put off by it, because it's hard to think that tomorrow your house could be burned down or the tsunami could come or any one of a million other things that could happen. But if we live our lives waiting for those things, then we miss our life. We miss the opportunity to make spiritual progress. We miss the opportunity to be able to be living in joy right in this moment and in the next moment and in the next moment. And then just believe what Master said, that we will not suffer as much. Again, whatever that means, because we have no idea what's going on spiritually or from a karmic perspective. It's virtually impossible to know. We think we're in charge of our lives, we're in charge of anything, we're in charge of nothing. And there's all these wonderful stories that I think I mentioned this here 2 weeks ago when I was at SRW and I started my talk by saying, look, many, many years ago, Master picked me up out of Encinitas, plopped me down into Stanford, into medical school. I had no idea I was even going to medical school. And that is literally what happened in my life. And I imagine other people, I have many more stories I could tell. We have no idea. Our job is to be still and know that I am. That's what it's about. One moment at a time. So to listen to what the simple words about kindness that were probably spoken last week or whatever Tandava and Stephen are about to stand up here and talk about with non-attachment, but to remind ourselves, Swami Kriyananda knew exactly what he was doing. He created this very simple-looking little outline, and if we can live by it, if we can take one little lesson home each night that we're here, or two or three little reminders, and live by them, then he will have succeeded in passing these lessons on just the way he wanted, and then we'll do what he asked us to do, which is then take them out and teach them. So, with that.
So, Shanti mentioned the fires. They're happening up in Lake County, and my dad and stepmom were actually some of the ones who evacuated on Saturday. And as of now, the fire has sort of just gone past their house, and it hasn't been burned down, but I looked at the map, and it's right around it. So who knows? Just on the subject of non-attachment, they evacuated Saturday. On Sunday, my dad was giving Sunday service in a Unity church in another city on the subject of non-attachment and did not even mention the fire. And I don't want to joke about these things, but Dad would let me, so. So, yeah, we have to sort of always be aware, like Shanti was saying, it doesn't have to be a worldwide cataclysm. It can be anything. And we never know when we are going to be forcibly detached from whatever we may have in our lives. So it's worth sort of practicing being ready, because at the very least, spoiler alert, we all die. And then we don't get to take our house and our nice things and our family along with us. And so this is what the yogis just throughout time have just always practiced. You know, it's going to happen, so let's just be ready so we don't freak out when it does. Now, this can be a little bit intimidating because we think about our house burning down, we think about people we love dying, all these things, and we don't feel like we can just drop this cold turkey, and we can't. That is not actually the way we're expected to go about this. Like every other sort of growth and development, it's progressive. It's step by step by step. So what sort of steps do we take to practice this? Gandhi had a fantastic saying, which has always been one of my favorites. Never give up a pleasure until you've replaced it with a higher pleasure. So that's saying you don't have to force yourself through grueling austerities to do things you don't want to do and to avoid doing things you really like. You can develop naturally. This is very similar. I felt like there's a connection to the what we said in, I think, the first class, maybe. If a duty conflicts with a higher duty, it ceases to be a duty. And what both of these things are saying is everything is step by step. Wherever you are on the spectrum of enlightenment, you know, from dirt to God, you're in there somewhere. And the next step you take is not based on looking all the way up at where God is. It's looking right where you are and saying, okay, there's this on this side, this on this side. Which do I do? And each one is accessible. As an example of this, for about 10 or 12 years, my main hobby, my main social interaction with people was dancing. I did a lot of ballroom dancing, folk dancing, like, you know, 1, 2, 3 nights a week for years and years and years. I'm a monk right now. You know, it's not really the best hobby for a monk. And I don't go out dancing, you know, anymore, basically, for the last 3 years. But if, you know, I had shown up the first time in the Ananda Temple or for Med One or for discipleship or something and said, oh, by the way, you have to just stop this or you can't come here, you know, it wouldn't have happened. And there was a couple years period where, you know, I was doing both. It was fine because nobody said, you know, you can't just do both. But as time went on, you know, I was still dancing and I was still doing other things. I was meditating, I was chanting, I was singing in the choir. I was serving, I was doing all the things that we do around here at Ananda and discovering different types of pleasures and how they affected me. And I could look at this one thing that I enjoyed, dancing, and how it affected me and the sort of enjoyment and pleasure I got out of it, which was very energetic, yes, all very rajasic, very hard to settle down afterwards, a real mix of lots of different people's energies because you run into lots and lots of different people. And what we've got going on at Ananda, which is a much, you know, calmer, more focused energy, and just feels very different, you know, and the after effects linger in a very different way. And just as time went on, you know, I was still kind of enjoying the dancing, but maybe not as much, or maybe I just didn't like how I felt afterwards when I was exhausted the next day or whatever. And I was enjoying all of this more and more and more. And it just gradually shifted. And I never just said, I am never going to dance again. But, you know, after a while, you know, I didn't so much want to. And I wanted to be doing everything else that I was doing here. And this happened, you know, just, you know, a little, maybe over the course of the 6 months before I became a monk, which made the possibility of that open to me at all. You know, I don't think I wasn't even considering it before, but now it was visible as something I could do. And dance, for a long time, was a very good thing for me to do. I learned a lot about interacting with people, a lot about self-confidence, a lot about energy, a lot of very useful topics that have served me very, very well. And it was very important. So at that stage, you know, 15 years ago now, whenever it was, that was a forward-moving thing. It was a higher pleasure than whatever I was doing before, probably. But it's been a progression, and everything's moved on like this. And so this goes not just for hobbies, things we enjoy doing. It goes for anything we're attached to, including ways of being, you know, our emotional habits, our behavioral habits, which are things we're attached to, even if we don't think of it that way. And what this course offers throughout are basically higher level habits and things that you can become attached to to replace other lower things that we may have been attached to. And even though we're talking about non-attachment, I'm going to say it's okay to be attached to some of these things because you're basically climbing up a ladder. You got to grip each rung as you're going up. But when you grip that new one, you're able to let that lower one go. And if you keep going up in the direction of God, then you eventually get where you want to be. So if you have a tendency towards, for instance, anger, that's clearly sort of a lower expression, a lower pleasure. If some people actually like getting angry, it's weird. but if you have something like that, or insert your favorite vice here, you know, then develop, actually deliberately cultivate an attachment to, for instance, kindness, everything we spoke about last week, or again, anything we talk about in all these 6 weeks. And if you just really practice being kind, let yourself feel attached to it, identify with it, it's higher than that, you know, and it'll climb you up the ladder. And kindness, you know, it's an expansion of the ego. You're thinking about other people. It's not all about me, which anger is a little bit more all right here. Swami Kriyananda spent a lot of time with Ananda Mahima in India. He was very receptive, Swami was. And so he could spend a lot of time with Ananda Mahima, who was a great woman saint of the last century. And she could give him a lot because he could receive so much. And at one point he said, you know, I feel kind of bad, you know, is this sort of selfish of me? I'm taking up all your time, you know, you have lots of devotees. And she said, it's not selfish to desire what dissolves the ego. Because if you're working on dissolving the ego, anything that selfishness would attach to loses its ability to attach to it. So basically, don't worry about it. Climb up the ladder, get each next good step that you can get, whatever seems most accessible. If kindness isn't resonating right now, pick another quality from this whole course and just grab onto it, let yourself be attached to it. So many things to think about. Said where to go, which direction. Patanjali lists non-attachment in a couple ways in the Yoga Sutras. There's a section called the Yamas and the Niyamas, which are the do's and don'ts, sort of the yogic equivalent of the Ten Commandments. In the Ten Commandments, we have non-stealing, and Patanjali has that one too, and that's pretty clear. You know, I shouldn't go take your stuff, and because that's a low expression of consciousness. It's thinking about me and what I want and not considering that may actually belong to you. But Patanjali also has something that is often translated as, is this right, non-possession, which is that even things that are yours, don't get too attached to them. Because, again, we could die, the thing could break, the person that we love can die, it's not really ours. You know, it's on loan, sort of, for as long as God deems it can be ours, but don't be too attached to it. And this doesn't mean you can't have things, and this is in previous ages, you know, the classical images of a monastery, everybody gets a little cell, it's all stone, they sleep on a bit of straw, and that's it, they don't have anything. Because in those kind of times, the idea was, well, you just gotta beat your ego out with a stick, and that's all there is to it. What we're working on nowadays is more consciousness-based, which is that, you know, it's okay to have things. You may have to have things to do your job, to interact with society, etc., but you don't have to have an internal attachment in your consciousness to these things. And there's a story from India about Sukdeva and Raja Janaka, and I forget the initial situation, but Sukdeva had gone to see Raja Janaka, and the king was there in his great big palace and everything like that, and here comes this sage or student, I forget who he was, and he had his books and things, and he wanted to do you remember, did he want to learn, or was he going to go test the king and see how enlightened he was? Okay, so Sukdeva was sent to Raja Janaka to learn from him, but he started thinking, oh, this guy is a king, he has a palace, he has money, you know, he's not a proper world-renouncing yogi, he can't be the real deal. And so he's in the throne room talking with the king, and Raja Janaka, being indeed a very enlightened sage as well as a king, brought up a vision, an illusion of flames, the entire palace going up in fire. And he just sat there calmly talking with Sukdeva, and the flames were drawing closer and closer, and everybody was running out, and Sukdeva was getting more and more nervous, and Raja Janaka was sitting there talking to him, and finally Sukdeva grabs his books they brought with him and clutches them to him and starts to run out, and Raja Janaka goes, oh, who's attached now? You know, I'm watching my entire palace burn, but, you know, you think you're such a sage, such a yogi, you still, like, whatever it is, you've got your books, you're attached to them. So in consciousness, you know, one of them may not have had very much at all, but he really wanted to hang on to what he had, and one of them had an awful lot, and burned down, doesn't matter. And that's sort of where we want to go. And it's much more subtle, so we have to be careful as we work with this, because we can't just collect all the things that we want and say, well, I'm not attached to them because they're not burning up right now, so you can't prove that I'm not. So you have to be honest with yourself, too. But that's more the level that we're working with. Another subtle level of things that we get attached to is the things that we do and the results of the actions that we take. And this is a big theme of the Bhagavad Gita, and the term is nishkam karma. It means action without desire for the results of the action. We talked about dharma, I think, in the first class, the idea of, like, what is the right thing to do? And we should still be interested in that as a question. And we should still do our best. This is where we still have the subtlety coming in. But we should recognize that whatever we do, it will succeed or fail, and that is sort of not our business. If we've done our best, it's up to God what the actual results are going to be. Another way this is often put is God is the doer. You know, if God has manifested through all of us, then he is in fact literally the doer through me, even if I feel that it was me. But it's a way of sort of saying, reminding myself, you know, if it worked out well, great, yay God. If it failed, his fault, sorry, not me. because we're not being attached to it. And this is worth keeping in mind, especially as we sort of go up the rungs of this ladder into higher and higher aspirations, because, you know, if you've gotten this high on the ladder, it's sort of easy to look down below and go, yeah, it doesn't matter if I succeed or fail in those things because I know they're not important anymore. But right here, you know, this one feels important. You know, this is where I am. This is where I'm hanging on. This is the next thing I'm really trying to do. I'm kind of attached to it. And that's where it gets tricky, especially since a lot of these things are, you know, pretty clearly good things. Our meditation, for instance. Once early on, I'd been meditating maybe a year or something, I was just having trouble with my meditations, and Asha said something to me, which was, remember, even meditation is nishkam karma. You know, it doesn't have to feel like a good meditation. Get your butt on the cushion, do your hong sa, and if it feels great, great. If it doesn't, great. You know, don't be attached. You know, you do your part, and God will have it work out however he wants to work it out. I had an interesting sort of extended lesson in this about a year ago when I went on seclusion. And so I went up to the Ananda Meditation Retreat, which if you haven't been there, you must go. You can rent a cabin out in the woods and just meditate on your own for as long as you want, which if that's your thing, it's really great. And I loved it the first time I went. So this was the second time I was going to go into seclusion. I gave myself 9 days. I brought all the food I was going to need. I wasn't going to talk to anybody. I had all planned out. I was going to meditate, you know, so many hours every day. I was going to do yoga so many hours a day. I was going to chant. I had the autobiography of a yogi. I had the Bhagavad Gita. You know, I was set, and it was going to be great. And I got there, and just nothing worked. And I was sitting there trying to meditate. I was doing the yoga, and I was just feeling worse and worse and worse until, you know, like 3-4 days into it, I was basically like, I found myself in the afternoon kind of sitting around in a chair going, bleh. And it's like, okay, this is what it's come to. This is not so great. time to back up a little bit and reevaluate what's going on here. And finally, and sometimes, I don't know, you just see the little pinprick of light and you grab it and then you go from there. And the pinprick that appeared to my mind was Swami said, to get joy from meditation, meditate with joy. Bring whatever joy you have to the table and then let meditation increase it. Well, I didn't have anything to be starting with. And I was beating myself up for not having as good a seclusion as I meant to. But what I did have was a book of P.G. Wodehouse stories, which if you don't know P.G. Wodehouse, he was a British humorist, and Swami Kriyananda really enjoyed his stuff, and it's just lighthearted humor. And so I went, all right, I have no other ideas. I came here to give 9 days of my life to God, and if he wants me to spend them reading Jeeves and Wooster instead of the Bhagavad Gita, so be it. So it was great. I love those stories. So I started reading them, and I started cheering up, and I started feeling better. I sort of backed off of the meditation. I wasn't pushing it as much, just kind of my normal amount instead of tons and tons extra. And it really shifted there. Another thing, this is still all in the same trip, a few days later, the water in the shower started coming out just all brown and icky and the kitchen sink was still clear, so okay, I had drinking water. I think, I ran it for a long time, seeing if it would clear stuff out of the pipes, nothing doing. You know, I gave it a day and I thought, you know, I got a few more days, maybe I don't have to shower before I go home, you know. And so I was trying to stick it out because I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was trying to have a silent seclusion. And then finally I just, okay, I can't do this anymore. I got to have clean water in the shower. So, all right, no more silent seclusion, whatever, God, I'm just going to go tell somebody. I walk over to the office, and I tell them about it, and I walk back. Before I even get back to the cabin, Brandon has gotten there ahead of me in his truck, is inside running the water in the bathroom, and he says, oh, you know, just does this sometimes. You've run it a bit, it comes clear, look, it's already fine. This is after like 2 days of me doing that. And I always know when God has gotten something through to me because I start laughing. I'm just like, oh, you got me that time. So again, this is me having my idea that I was very attached to. My seclusion kind of has to be like this. And God's saying, like, come on, you don't have to be attached even to that. And one other piece of the puzzle, which is going on concurrently to all of this. So I had a spot up on the hill where I like to go in the mornings before it gets too hot and eat my breakfast. And there's this nice rock you can sit on, great view, you can see all the way down to the river. I loved it. I was up there every day the first year I did my seclusion. So I go up there the first day, first morning of my seclusion, and I can't find the place. And there's not a lot of places you can go on that hill because most of it's overgrown and there are just a few paths. And I could not for the life of me find it. And so finally I went off and I found myself another breakfast spot and I ate breakfast there and it's fine. Okay, but it felt really weird that I couldn't do it. So I decided, okay, I need to be paying more attention to something here. And so I made a habit every day. I would get to a particular fork in the trail and I knew the place I wanted to go was off to the right somewhere. And my other breakfast spot was off to the left. So every day I would get up to the trail, get to the fork and close my eyes and get very still and just try and feel, do I need to turn right? I need to turn left. And if I didn't feel really clear, go this way, I would just not even bother looking for it. I would just head off to the other side. Until several days into it, and it was probably about the time that I started reading P.G. Woodhouse and everything started shifting. I get up to the fork in the road and I just hear right, and I just head off there and I walk straight to the spot that I wanted to find the whole time. And the really interesting thing was I went back to my journal from the previous year and I had written down very clearly how to get to that spot and it was very clearly wrong. So I don't know if it moved or what. but again, I just, okay, like God's just playing with me. He's trying to teach me something. So now again, everything is relative. So I'm not saying it's, you know, don't be attached to meditation. It doesn't matter how much you meditate. No, if I were here at home and making a resolution that I'm going to meditate more instead of, you know, futzing around on the internet for an extra hour a day or something, that would definitely be progress. And that would probably be worth being attached to and really putting out some energy to make that happen. Note to self, do that. but I was going to the seclusion, and I was, instead of, like I said, giving 9 days of my life to God, saying, here, what shall we do? I was going, I'm going to do this. No, I don't want to listen to you. I'm going to do this. And instead of doing all that I laid out for myself, sure, I meditated some. I did some yoga, not crazy amounts. But I also spent time really tuning in, you know, every day at the fork in the trail, just really getting still and feeling the guidance, getting open enough eventually to listen to, like, hey, you should do something else with your seclusion. Okay, I will. And that kind of attention, that kind of communication, that connection was worth a lot more than beating my head against more hours of meditation than I could reasonably manage at the time. So again, it's all progressive. Another a story, I think, from China reminds me of that too, about two monks who are traveling and they're just walking a long walk from probably one monastery to another, and they come to a river and there's a lady waiting by the river and she's like, oh, I can't cross, can somebody help me cross the river? So the older monk picks her up. They wade across the river. They set her down. She goes her way. They go their way. And they walk on a couple more miles. And the younger monk is gradually fuming more and more and more. And he finally bursts out and goes, "What were you doing? We're monks. We're not supposed to even look at women, much less touch them. You carried her across the river. What's going on?" And the older monk said, "I put her down back at the river. Are you still carrying her?" So that rule about monks and women is useful for the most part, and you know, that younger monk especially was probably, you know, really good to have a solid rule. It says, like, don't do this, you know, stay focused, because you're going to be really easily unfocused. This older monk knew how detached he was from that, you know, internally, in himself, and therefore could be more detached even to the rule and do the appropriate thing, show compassion for somebody, help her across the river, and then just let go, both of her and the situation and the rule and everything, and it didn't actually touch him. Another point Swami makes in the notes is non-attachment is not indifference. And this, again, is something that people can fall into when they're not trying to just take it step by step to the next natural phase of development. We think, oh, I need to be non-attached. I need to not care about anyone, about anything. And that is not the right way to go. It doesn't actually help expand the ego, because now you're thinking just all about myself. I am not going to be attached to anything, so I'm not going to care about it. It's just me in the world, as opposed to that older monk who could perfectly well recognize that there's a person and care about her enough to help her out of her difficulty, but then just let it go, which is a much more appropriate way of behaving. And also, even for, you know, whatever rung of the ladder we're on, we need to put our energy into that. You know, if we're trying to let go of anger by grabbing onto kindness, we need to put some energy and attention and care into learning to be a kind person, or whatever it is that we're working on, because that's how you actually move step to step. The thing with just letting go is there's nowhere to direct energy. You know, you have all this energy that you've been gripping with, and now where does it go? You can't just let go. You have to grab on to something else, so you keep directing the energy upwards. And in terms of caring about people, you know, attached love does not necessarily feel more loving. You know, what do we call? Well, what we sort of see is the ideal epitome of love. We use the term unconditional love, right? Because the person doing the loving has no needs or attachments of their own that they're trying to get out of the other person, no conditions that they're putting from themselves onto this person in order to love them. They just love them. And that kind of love is actually much more loving, and you can feel it as the recipient, compared to somebody who is so attached to you being this way or doing these things, or somebody who just needs something from you, you know, somebody who really needs you to love them back or whatever it is. You know, that can actually not be very magnetic, because what they're really exuding is need more than love. So actually what happens the more we can get ourselves detached is being able to just love more freely, because we also don't have anything, you know, our energy isn't used up in holding on to these conditions that we think are essential. The energy can all just go towards loving. Swami makes a point that some languages are actually explicit about this, or honest in some ways. Spanish, one of the phrases for saying "I love you" is actually "te quiero," I want you, which, you know, even not in Spanish, is probably the more appropriate way to say it for a lot of people, because a lot of people go into relationships really needing or wanting something from somebody else. That's what gets a lot of people into a lot of trouble in a lot of relationships. But then, you know, look at the happiest, most loving connections and relationships, and just see how more sort of more open and free they are, because they're not just so reliant on specific things being specific ways. And the ultimate example of this is, guess who? Our gurus. Because they are already fully enlightened, liberated, free. They don't need anything from us. And they love us naturally because they can actually see us as God, whom they already love. And it's just the purest expression, and all they want to do is just draw us closer and closer back to God. And again, this is how we get these teachings, Yogananda, our guru, through Swami, through the Akash class, through all of us sitting up here and talking about these, you know, one step at a time. You know, it just gives us all these steps to climb back up there. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Stephen.
Thank you, Tandava. That was a great intro for me, actually. You laid the groundwork beautifully. Wow, this thing is loud. You know, this I'm so taken with this course this year. I've known this course for a few years and have been involved with giving various segments of it. And I don't know, there's something about this year where I'm seeing it in a different way. And I was thinking that in this chapter, as I was preparing, particularly earlier today, you know, the Tandava went over particularly, in the way Swami has laid out this chapter, my part has a couple more non-attachment things. And then he goes into this whole other arena of our teachings, which he's offered over the years, and Master offered over the years, but I've never quite seen it offered in this particular way. And I think that's one of the things I'm realizing about this class, is that the way he uses the language is so helpful to me, and ideally to all of us. But so I want to, you know, I kind of like reading these points because his wording is better than mine, as it turns out, not surprisingly. So this is, you know, again, just these are simple things. Are your clothes your own? Because we've been working our way through what we can be attached to, and of course what we can be non-attached to. Many people worked on them before you bought them, referring to our clothes. Each of them probably felt some personal involvement. And do you identify yourself with what you wear? You remove it at night. Do you remove a part of yourself? And he continues, your body too is only a form of clothing. Someday you will have to leave this body behind you. The body grows as you grow up from childhood. Then gradually it grows old, develops wrinkles, grows feeble. Eventually, you will have to shed it. Are you this body? If so, which of these different bodies is really yours? No, you are not the body at all. Your body will change over incarnations. Then he goes on to say, we're not a particular race, we're not a particular gender. So, you know, you get the idea here. This whole idea of who we are is really at the core of this section. And it's really easy to get attached to who we are. You know, we kind of like the way we look when we look in the mirror on a particular day. Or, you know, we have those days where it works. And there's something appealing about it. And other days, it's like, all right, we'll try again. But regardless, you can see how easy it is to sort of just get in there. And you know, our world gets so narrow when we do that. The way to expand our consciousness is to really, for me, to think about what is it I'm actually identifying with. And so in another way is, how can I make progress in this lifetime? How can I let go of this when it's so dear to me, right? It's just so dear to me, and I really like it. You know, at certain times, I really like what I am, and I really like the way I think, and my opinions just seem right. And others don't. But what is that? So what is that? That is ego. Talked about this last week. Master simply defined ego as the soul identified with the body. Right? So if we're, and we forget, it's really easy to forget that we're the soul, because we may even know we're a soul. Intellectually, we understand we're a soul, but we really find the soul in this just wonderfully appealing package. And it's not so easy to not think about this part of the package and only think about the soul. But what I found helpful for me is to think about what the soul is really a part of. And therefore, what am I beyond this really limited, fleeting, bag of flesh, right? Because it's pretty clear after a few years that it is going, and it's going pretty quickly. You know, these parts go, and those are the ones that are really alarming. But if we are able to step back and we're able to really think about larger pieces of time, it can get esoteric if we start thinking along those lines. But what I really like to think about is, where do my thoughts come from? Where do my ideas come from? Where do my opinions come from? And who gave them to me to begin with? And this is where I'm finding that I'm actually making some progress. I have a business that I run. It's a small business. It's a one-man business. And I've gone through these various incarnations of it. I left a job I had, which by definition of most people was a very secure job that could have served me well for the rest of my life had I chosen some level of wisdom and actually kept going at it. And I didn't want to. And I knew there was something driving me that wasn't ego. And I can't tell you how challenging it was to come up against people who I respected greatly, who were very clear that I was really being foolish here, that I was being stubborn about things that weren't important, that I was, they didn't come out and say it, but in essence, immersed in ego, and that's why I was doing this, and I didn't need to be doing this. And I have no doubt there was some level of truth to that, but I knew there was something more, I just didn't know what it was. I had initial failure, big failure. Went into a business that I knew very little about and then jumped off a cliff and figured out a way to survive. It was very interesting. It was a very interesting experience. And that was, that was like year one. And it was like, wow, my God, we almost lost everything. Came very, very close. And I was able to salvage something and continue. And I had to just reinvent it, and it took 3 years. 3 years before I made any money. My dear wife Rita, very patient, was not happy about this, understandably. Thank God she was willing. She's a hard worker. It's really nice. She has kept this going. And at a certain point, I just turned a corner, and lo and behold, I came upon this model, and the next thing I knew, it's like, wow, I did this and this. This nice check came in. I hadn't had a check in 3 years. And then I did it again, and a check twice the size came in. And I did it again, and that same double size check came in. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. We've got it. We'll just continue doing it. And it abruptly ended. 4 checks. Good checks, but 4 checks. Maybe a year's worth of income from 4 checks. Nonetheless, done. Couldn't resurrect it for a variety of reasons. And I thought, okay, we've got to start something else. So I phased in something else, made some money again. Thought, fantastic, we've changed that. Ended. 5 years until I made money again. I earned money, I got jobs. But until 5 years. And then a year ago, I came upon another formula, not of my invention, and now it's taking hold. So the reason I'm mentioning it is this. I have really had to detach myself from it in so many ways. Detach myself from the failure, detach myself from the futility, from the opinions of others, from the feeling that I was letting my wife down, being a fool, God knows what else. Because I knew there was something more to this. And I decided to take the approach that I've got to see how I can grow spiritually through this. That if nothing else, this set of experiences will really help me become a much humbler individual, right? And also, if I'm able to learn these lessons of humility and non-attachment, my whole spiritual life will be transformed. And that's what I have seen now has been changing, because there's been a change in my spiritual life, and I largely attribute it to what I've been able to do with this business. And that has really very little to do with whether it's financially successful or not. The fact that there's money coming in is a nice thing, right? I mean, it's a lot easier, face it. But regardless, I realized that if I learned how to put out energy in the appropriate way and sustain it, if I learned how to really, in my interactions with people, and really, because I know my own tendencies, continually be kind, continually be supportive, consciously, every time I'm on the phone with somebody, realize I am there for them. I am there to support them, no matter what they're saying to me, no matter how unpredictable their behavior, no matter how untruthful their conversation. And it's been fascinating to detach myself from the result, nishkam karma, and to use it as a laboratory. I realized this is life. We can use life. We can take a spirit of non-attachment and use any aspect of our life as a laboratory. So that, and it doesn't matter what happens, right? Sister Gyanamata, Master's greatest woman disciple. The things that happen to us do not matter, she said. What we become through them does. It's as true as it gets. The life lasts about this long. However much money one gets, right? And you sort of look around. It's like, oh, this one got it this way. This one inherited it. This one worked really hard. This one has great money karma. At this point, the end, it's all gone. Not a penny stays with us. Not a penny. Nothing. Investments, right? People work for their retirement. And why wouldn't you, right? Because your chances are you're going to retire. And you need to have some money. But nonetheless, there are people who spend their whole lives on this stuff. And it all goes. Okay. So what are we identifying with? If it's not the body, if it's not our personality, if it's not our skin, color, ethnicity, gender, any of that stuff. Right? Dandava said very simply, God is the doer. Swami talks about this. God is the doer. What does that really mean? Well, if we are willing to think of ourselves as a receptacle, there's this wonderful chant, I am but an empty vessel. I really like that chant. I am but an empty vessel filled with the presence of God. It's a really helpful image. I've just found it to be such a helpful image. And if indeed on a given day I'm on the phone, it can be really helpful to think I am but an empty vessel filled with the presence of God. Because if somebody on the other end of the phone, when your business is really fascinating, especially a business like real estate that I'm in, because it attracts some unbelievable group of people. Not all of them who are in it are that way. There are many really fine people and very ethical people. But it's one of these areas where people think, I'm going to make a fast buck. And a lot of people who want to make a fast buck are willing to do it in any way they can. It doesn't really matter. The buck is what matters. Which is actually interesting because my father, who passed away 3 years ago, was actually a very good man, but he had certain sayings. One of which was, he used to say to me, Stephen, when you've got a buck, you've got a friend. And he was serious. And I thought, wow, you really believe that? And he did. It was so interesting. And a lot of people believe that. He was an attorney. My dad was a lawyer. And he had that whole side. So I was very familiar with that side. He had a much nicer side as well. But that side just would come out at times. You'd be sitting at a dinner table, and all of a sudden that side would come out. And it's like, what? What is that about? What do you mean? It's like you all of a sudden feel like you're on the witness stand. And literally, this lawyer is just like hammering you because that's what he knows how to do. It's really amazing. And people do this in business all the time. It's so interesting with individuals because What are we identifying with? If we're identifying with the dollars, it's really easy to go down that rabbit hole. If we're a devotee, and I am but an empty vessel filled with the presence of God, well, it's a little different approach to business. Very helpful if one is so inclined. Very few are inclined, as we know. I'll digress and I'll come back to this. Swami lays out this groundwork in this chapter about the... Well, basically, he talks about what the caste system is in India. And he talks about its origin and what it really means at a spiritual level, what it's become. In its essence, the caste system was a way that wise people understood in a higher age that humanity seems to sift itself out into four basic levels. I mean, there's more subtlety to it, but the essence of it is that you have, this level of sifting is strictly, at its highest form, it's strictly related to consciousness. The consciousness that we exhibit, and more related to the overall point that I'm making here, or premise, is that we are what we attune ourselves to. That's our true identity. When we strip away everything else, when we strip away this flesh, we are what we attune ourselves to. And it's that understanding, the adoption of that understanding has been very, very helpful for me. It's that one can carry you a long way, because it's so much more fulfilling to know that we can ride that. We can ride that stream of consciousness, right? If we are really conscious of attuning ourselves to the presence of Yogananda. You know, Master talked about the poem Samadhi, read it every day as a way of attuning ourselves to him. It's one tool of many he gave us. And he said, literally, if you do 1/100th of what I bring you, you will find God. So take one. It doesn't really matter. Literally, it does not matter. They're all infused with that same highest level of consciousness. But nonetheless, we are what we attune ourselves to. So this idea of consciousness, the lowest level of consciousness, is one where we're really kind of dead. We're half alive in the sense that we're not tuning into much that's above ground, shall we say. We really need to be prodded. So it manifests itself in individuals, what is called a peasant consciousness, which is, you know, many people use as a pejorative these days, but it's descriptive nonetheless. And that's basically, you know, there's this premise we talk about on the spiritual path that for all of us, we're motivated by seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. And that's true. We just do it at different levels. The lowest level of that is basically, I don't do anything unless somebody really is going to, you know, give it to me if I don't. Right? So if a person, you know, whatever job it might be, who knows? I mean, my brother actually is a very funny guy. I'm going to see him in a couple of weeks in Chicago. We grew up in Chicago. And, you know, Chicago is filled with all these Eastern European people. And, you know, our family was from Eastern Europe. So, but, you know, there'd be these janitors. You just see these Eastern European janitors. And they all just seemed to have this particular consciousness. And it was like this Shudra mentality. And it was like, boss says rake, I'll rake. I rake. And that's it. The boss says to do this, I do it. But that's the only reason I do it. I don't take any initiative. I don't exhibit any creativity. If I don't do it, I'm not going to get paid. So boss says rake, I rake. Okay. That's a Shudra. There are a lot of Shudras around. It's very, you can see it's pretty low. It's low energy, right? Higher level of that is called the Vaishya. And that is that I still want, but I'm willing to give in order to get. And you can see there's a real difference. Here, I'm only willing to give if somebody's going to hammer me if I don't. Right? That's like, whew. Next level, a little more energy, Vaishya consciousness. It's called the merchant class, though it's not really about that per se, but it's descriptive. I give only in exchange for something. Right? I know I'm going to get it, so I'm willing to give. And that's like, it's got to be 50-50. Right? I encounter this a lot in my business. I mean, it's amazing. It's just amazing. And it's generally that I'll give, the premise is generally I'll give 10, but I want 90. But nonetheless, put on a little something. And, you know, there's a lot of humanity like that. Higher level, and then, you know, then there are those of us who are more interested in other people, right, who are moving up into the level of kshatriya. Kshatriya is a much more noble pursuit. And it's one of the images is of the warrior. And Swami talks about this, why warrior, people who are actually killing others, you know, it doesn't seem like it's really high. But the premise here is that you are willing to sacrifice yourself for something higher. Right, the highest level of warrior, king, or soldier, and you know there are a lot of honorable people like this who are, you know, they're really quite admirable when you meet them. They're literally willing to sacrifice their lives as an offering to something higher. Principle. I mean, at its highest, it's to principle. This is a very high calling for many people, and it's certainly a progression. Some of us may feel that we're in a kshatriya mode. And it's a good place to be. It's a really good place to be if you're on a spiritual path. Because, see, this is related to this to what we're attached to and to what we're identifying with. If we're identifying with something larger than ourselves, clearly we're not limiting our identity to this little entity here. If we're willing to sacrifice this little entity here, we are practicing non-attachment. To a great degree. I mean, if you're willing to go into battle and you're accepting of the fact that this may end in a flash, that's not attachment. That's a very, very good thing. And yet there's a higher level than that. The higher level of the Brahman is, I'm here to help others find. I'm here to find God myself, but even more so, I'm here to help others find God. And that is the premise. That's the premise of life is I'm here to find God, and the fullest expression of it is everything else is secondary to that, and I know that I'm only going to find God when I help others do the same thing. Right? Now, that's not a Vaishya mentality that I'll only help others because that's the only way I'm going to find God. It's simply an understanding. It's an unfoldment of understanding, and one could accurately say it's an expression of wisdom. It's just simply knowing this is the way it works. This is the way God set up the world, and we are willing to enter into that phase beyond, certainly incorporating, but beyond the level of even self-offering, willingness to sacrifice ourselves. It's, you know, and then of course there are people at that level, it's like, God will provide, you know. I don't really think about my sustenance day to day, or I set it up in some very simple, practical way, and that's it. I don't worry about, oh, I need more money, or I need more in my retirement, or I need this nicer apartment. It's like, I've got the basics covered. Great, now I can go there. Right? It's a very, very nice way of approaching life. So if we're in... you know, the metaphysical perspective is that the ego is seated here at the medulla chakra, soul identified with the body, where we're really locked in body consciousness if our awareness is all the way back here. And then we talked a little bit last week about this idea of bringing it forward. And I mentioned this idea of the spiritual path being, you know, 6-7 inches long, because it's taking our identity from this place all the way up ultimately to the point between the eyebrows, which, so here we're identifying with this, again, this limited thing, entity, and here we're identifying with all of creation. And that's a pretty big leap, because, you know, we could identify with, you know, maybe a dozen people in this room, that's progress, but all of creation is bigger still, right? It's like, it's the penultimate. And that's where the avatars are, were, continue to be, have been and show us. And the other set of principles that Swami is offering in this chapter related to that is the idea of the gunas. And I actually want to read the language that he uses in that. We've got a few minutes left, because this is really nice. The gunas are expressions of energy. We talk about energy endlessly here for very good reason. Very often, we talk about energy and its relationship to our physical presence and kind of the way we move through the world. This chapter, I'm realizing, is more related to energy, and that's so in the three bodies that we have, the coarsest level of existence is the physical, more refined is that level of energy, and we use it as an entry point. So often, we use it as an entry point to deal with the physical, to be able to uplift the physical. The highest level still is that level of consciousness. That's even more refined than the level of energy. These principles, I'm realizing, are really related to that. They're expressing that relationship between energy and consciousness. And that's what the gunas are really about. So you hear the word guna, it's like, what does it mean? They're qualities. So he said, the gunas, or qualities, pervade all of nature. In human beings, and these are qualities of expression of energy and consciousness. In human beings, they manifest as mental dullness. That's the lowest level, tamoguna, mental dullness. The next level, energetic activity, rajoguna. Again, these are Sanskrit words. Guna is this quality, and then there's the descriptive. Oh, this is the identifier. Tamoguna is the lowest quality, mental dullness. Raja is this energetic activity. And then the third type, is this, it's a series of expressions called sattva guna. You hear the term sattvic. Oh, that's sattvic. It's a very sattvic environment. Sattva guna he expresses as these spiritual qualities such as kindness, contentment, generosity, forgiveness, and the like, right? Which happened to be the premise of this course. Right. So, tamoguna is exemplified by mental dullness and stupidity, the lack of any desire for self-improvement. Since this guna is closely allied to the Shudra caste, right, we talked about that, it will often be best, just as like an aside, it will often be best for a Shudra to serve as a servant in the home of a Vaishya. Meaning, the Shudra benefits by being with somebody at a higher level. Right? And because it's magnetism. Right, that's a magnetism that will draw that person upward. In a similar fashion, tangentially, Master used to talk about animals and how they benefit from their contact with human beings, because human beings are more evolved, both physically and spiritually. We have this capacity as a human being, with a central nervous system and brain. We have the capacity to feel and relate to God's presence. No other animals do. So other animals benefit from contact with us because it helps them move upward. It helps them grow. In a very similar fashion, the being with a higher level, higher caste in the truest sense, not in the way it's been, you know, calcified in India, that brings a person up from a lower level. But there was actually another point I wanted to turn to here. Basically, the idea is this. You've got these two poles. You've got sattva guna, you've got sattvic energy, which is expansive, which is inclusive, which is open. You know, people who are really, really spiritual people, you just feel it, you sense it. You don't have to, people don't have to pretend about this stuff. It's either there or it's not. So that's one end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum, you have this tamal guna, you know, it's very dull kind of people, you know, maybe people who drink a lot or just sit in bars, or they sit in bars and watch football games all day. I mean, it's a good combo. It's really a winning combination because it'll get you for a long time. Some of us have come up through that, in fact. So I speak from some level of experience. So here we are, these two ends of the spectrum. This is what I find so interesting about this one. So this idea of Rajaguna, you know, Asha talks about how this is a Rajasic galaxy, Rajasic planet. And because there's so much activity, there's a Rajasic area, there's just all this activity constantly, and many of us are immersed in it. You know, many people just go to live up in Ananda village because it's quiet there. And there's opportunity to do things in a different way. And that, you know, other people just don't want to be in that environment because they're just too Rajasic. And we like being here where there's just so much happening. But it's this, so that's that activating energy. But really what it's about is, what are we doing with that activating energy? Because you can take that activating energy and slide down in this direction toward slothfulness, where it's not so activating anymore. But that's part of what free, that's really a lot of what free will is. What are we doing with this energy that we have? To what are we relating? If we are attuning ourselves to something higher, Master famously said, environment is stronger than willpower. If we are aware of this concept and we are choosing, using this rajaguna, choosing to be in a more sattvic, uplifting environment, we're relating to a higher level of consciousness. We're expanding our sense of awareness. And in doing so, we're getting the taste of the nectar that comes with that. And that's what so much of what happens with us. We get these little droplets that are just so deeply fulfilling. And it might be just a moment, and it might be more, but it oftentimes is enough to keep us going. That's a conscious choice. Are we moving towards light? Are we moving away from light? Right? In essence, there's no such thing as darkness. There's light or there's lack of light. There's higher consciousness or there's lack of higher consciousness. The beauty of this chapter of non-attachment is that we can realize that the discipline of non-attachment, the practice of non-attachment, the understanding of the benefit of non-attachment is that it enables us to free ourselves from so much weight that has the ability to bring us down towards this more tamasic world. A lot of that self-identity weighs us down like shackles, right? Ball and chain that keeps us from elevating our consciousness. As we embrace this idea, and as everything else, and I'll end very soon here, I'll just go a couple more minutes. You know, we talked last time about this, the way things are created, that everything starts at the level of consciousness with a thought, and then it takes energy to bring it into actual physical manifestation. If we're willing to embrace that thought of non-attachment, it expands us to the extent that we're uplifted. That we're uplifted because this is what Master said, that when we make our effort, the guru steps in on our behalf, and as a result of that energy, it draws the grace of God. So this is like, you know, sort of the equation. I mean, I was never overly thrilled with the study of mathematics, but simple equations I like. We do our part, the guru comes in and does his or her part, in this case his, and then God loves it, comes, joins us all. But it's really, this is free will. This is where the exercise of free will becomes so tangible, because it's a concept that you don't even know what that means sometimes. But this is an area where it feels to me like it's this really wide channel that is there for us if we're willing to walk there. You know, most people don't even have any interest in anything like that. We ourselves may never have even encountered it in that way or thought of it in that way, but it's feeling to me like this, that non-attachment, that shedding of the bits of identity enables us to walk with such freedom into that world of sattvic energy, and in doing so, we draw the grace of God that really gets us to these places in life where a shift just happens. You know, sort of we're doing, and then a leap, and we're over here. It's like, God, that's great. That's so nice. I can actually feel greater freedom now. And it's reinforcing of that same type of behavior. Do it again, take another leap. And I think this, it's helpful sticking with the spiritual path, because there's so much that goes on. There's so much up and down. But I'm seeing, at least in my own life, and I imagine, you know, others among us can relate to this, that as we continue these processes, and that really is the beauty of this course, because it's distilled in these six chapters that, you know, are about this thick. You don't have to read 70 volumes here. I recommend the exercises. I won't go over them, but you've got copies of them. There's this fabulous set of exercises that I think are a great culmination to this. They are the great culmination to this chapter, but I think they're going to be very, very helpful for any of us. And there are two sets of exercises, but an exercise for this week, he basically says, do this first night, second night, third night, fourth night, and I think you'll find them of great benefit. Okay, thank you. Do we have any comments or questions of any sort? Anything at all? No? You're welcome. Happy to do so. Okay. Thank you all. God bless. We'll see you next week.